Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. This is the second part of episode 75, which is all about 1984. It's not a supplement as such. It's like, you know, when you're looking for a television programme late on a Friday night, perhaps something enriching like Mary Beard talking about Romans, and you stumble across one of those clip shows, you know, one of those that's showing things from the past with talking heads chatting about them. You feel like you might watch one of them, and before you know it, you're there for an hour and you're watching Anthea Turner fall out of the back of a van. You know, it's a bit like that. Well, I've been working hard getting ready for Grogmeet, which takes place in January 2025, a few weeks after this podcast is released. And this part of the episode, hot on the heels of the previous one. It's not all beer and hobnobs here in the den. It only really makes sense, this episode, if you listen to the first one first. Yes, it's us reminiscing about 1984 and some of the games that we played, and coming to the realisation that we had a very narrow palette to draw from. Indeed, in this episode, we issue a challenge to you, the listener. What were your enthusiasms back in 1984? And would you want to introduce them to us? Anyway, more about that later. Also, in this part of the episode, we have the triumphant return of the Daily Dwarf, who has written an overview of how 1984 looked in the great magazine White Dwarf, because everything comes back to White Dwarf. It's an essay that he's written that I'll read. I'll be back at the end with some shout-outs for new patrons. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
The White Dwarf!
1984 and all that. 1984, the year of Big Brother. War is peace, and the clock's striking 13. Not to mention the tensions and fears we all felt at the height of the Cold War. But never mind Orwell's warnings of totalitarian dystopia or the threat of imminent nuclear annihilation. More importantly, what was happening on the pages of White Dwarf magazine? Well, it had exited the previous year on a bit of a roll, with Khazad-dûm, Irelion, and Dealing with Demons all having been published. Could Games Workshop maintain this level of excellence and continue the golden era into another year? The issues with 1984 cover dates run from 49 to number 60 if you want to play along at home, from Shuttle Scuttle to the Bleeding Stone of Iptar, from character classes in RuneQuest, what? Much heresy, very anger, to an introduction to superhero gaming. This run included the landmark 50th issue, as well as the launch of the magazine into high street newsagents. Project John Menzies, as I've no doubt no one in Games Workshop called it. An attempt to consolidate White Dwarf's position in expanding the RPG market, and to take advantage of the interest generated from the fighting fantasy juggernaut. Departments still ruled the roost in the pages of the magazine, alongside the long-running stalwarts like Fiend Factory, Starbase, and Rune Rites, new departments appeared. Crash Course for Car Wars, Lose Views for the good old Dr. Pulsifer's ruminations on all things AD&D, and Tabletop Heroes, everything you wanted to know about lead figures from Messrs. Dever and Chalk. The book review column, Critical Mass, was joined by Counterpoint for board games and Microview for those newfangled microcomputers, whatever they were. departments everywhere you looked. But with more and more games appearing on the market, was the magazine becoming hidebound by this rigid structure? Was the room to innovate limited? Was the golden era coming to an end? Well, delving back into these 12 issues, I found that there's still a good deal of gaming goodness for the discerning role player. Now, I have covered several scenarios and articles from this run in previous bits of the podcast, and not wanting to repeat myself, I've decided to steal Dirk's 1D6 format from his blog and look at 5 highlights and 1 fumble. So, here we go. Trouble brewing. Everyone remember the hashtag Scenario Slam back in 2016? Anyone? No? Well, check out that era-defining contest on the Daily Dwarf blog, sports fans. While Curse of the Bone was the winner, the runner-up was The Black Brew of Dicegund from issue 51. Reading it again, it's an absolute belter. From the pen of Rockstar Games designer Ken Rolston, it was described as a RuneQuest cavern crawl and delivered exactly what it said on the tin. For me, what I want from a game of RuneQuest, I don't care who the god of kite flying is or who the play couch's grandparents are. I just want the PCs to pit their wits and their fighting skills against the worst creatures that Glorantha can throw at them. This scenario wasn't just a zoo dungeon, though. The PCs had to deal with both a formidable nest of chaos cultists, including, of course, the obligatory brew, as well as the environment itself. This was a particularly clever touch from Ken Rolston, I think. He introduced the concept of squeezes, areas around the caverns where passages were so small and restricted that the PCs could become trapped. A simple enough idea, but one that brought an extra level of threat to the characters as they delved deeper into the complex. After all, no one wants to get stuck fast in a tight squeeze when there's a scorpion man bearing down on them. The cavern map itself, though, was pretty complicated. Armchair adventurer Eddie described it on Twitter as looking like a mad woman's knitting. And he wasn't wrong. Hell, it's the pigs. Ah, yes. Mark Harrison's comic strip, The Travellers, divided the crowd back in 1984, and I think it still does today. It didn't have the same immediate appeal as the knockabout slapstick of Thrud, but really, how could you not love a strip that featured the Atari Death Squadron? Mark Harrison was clearly a player of the Traveller RPG, peppering the strip with terms from the game, mixed in with references and jokes inspired by Star Wars, Alien, Dune and the like. Admit it, that's what all our Traveller campaigns were like in 1984, yes? Well, not every gag landed. They came in thick and fast, and I enjoyed reading the strip all over again. If there's a particular strip of note, it'll be the one from issue 58, a collaboration with Nick Weeks, who provides many outstanding scenario maps in White Dwarf. Maybe it's just me, but I think in its two-page layout, I detected a homage to the venerable White Dwarf Traveller scenario, The Sable Rose Affair. A lovely touch. Mark's art style was occasionally frenetic, with little sight gags sometimes lost in the maelstrom. This also made the strip a little hard to follow at times, leaving me to wonder how the dialogue flowed and which panel came next. Mark has, of course, gone on to bigger things in the intervening years and now a regular artist for 2000 AD, but I still describe his art as being a bit fuzzy at the edges. What really comes into its own is when he's depicting alien worlds and cultures. Check out his recent work with writer Dan Abnett for the strip The Out in the Galaxy's Greatest Comic. While with some artists, alien worlds just look like a bus depot in Basingstoke with a bit of extra chrome and a few banks of flashing lights tacked on, The beautiful vistas painted by Mark in The Out look genuinely alien. Time rich, cash poor. Remember that time before the internet? When surprises were still possible? When you could turn to Open Box and read a review of a game that you'd never heard of before? There were a whole host of desirable items reviewed in 1984. Reading through all the columns again, it felt like a giant wants list, with some tasty supplements and scenarios for established games like Call of Cthulhu and Traveller, plus a few new RPGs like Daredevils and Espionage. Marcus Rowland particularly sold me on Espionage. Fast, easy to learn rules for playing CIA agents engaged in covert shenanigans. Sounds great. Anyone play this back in the day? Marcus's only complaint was the lack of rules for silencers. We also saw the dawn of the Dragonlance module series for AD&D. Graham Staplehurst finding similarities between DL1, Dragons of Despair, and a chunky book by a certain Professor Tolkien. Nowhere was the expansion of the RPG market more evident than the run-up to Christmas. In the final four issues of 1984, Open Box reviewed the James Bond 007 RPG, Middle-Earth role-playing, FASA's version of Star Trek, and both Ringworld and ElfQuest from Chaosium. The only problem back in 1984 was that, while I had plenty of time to play RPGs, O-level revision, what's that? I was not at home to Mr. Disposable Cash. And now, of course, that ratio is reversed. While I might have a bit more money to spend, time for gaming feels like sand running through my fingers. Ah, well, it's still fun to dream. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. Dying during character creation? Pah! With Andy Slack's Traveller article, To Live Forever, from issue 52, your characters could achieve immortality. This was a great, thought-provoking article, as you'd expect from the pen of Andy Slack. He looked not just at the means to achieve immortality at various tech levels. Drugs, surgery, bionics, clones, and more were all examined. But also the impact of characters living forever, both on an individual level and on societies at large. It asked some really interesting existential questions for player characters to explore and provided plenty of ideas for traveller adventures away from the usual amoral piracy fare that my group typically indulged in back in the day. The scenario outline at the end of the article left me scratching my head a bit though, even after reading the referee's information. But still, recommended. What did Fishhead just say? I've always been a bit of a sucker for a good trap, particularly if it's an elaborate construction with an accompanying cross-sectional diagram. In issue 58, it's a trap, though. Stephen Dudley eschewed the Heath Robinson-style excess, preferring to focus on the practicalities of traps. Why they were there, who sets them, how long they can be circumvented, etc. I enjoyed reading this article over again. In just a couple of pages, Stephen gave Games Masters a lot of useful advice on designing and locating traps. His comment that a trap should not leave too much mince made me chuckle. Nothing alerts player characters to a trap like suspicious lumps of viscera strewn about the dungeon corridor. The emphasis of the article was very much on avoiding Tomb of Horror style instant death traps, giving players agency in avoiding and disarming traps instead, while still allowing foolish and unwary characters to get their comeuppance. Great advice then, great advice now. And if you can't lay your hands on a copy of White Dwarf 58, check out Chris McDowell's excellent Electric Bastion Land instead for more quality trap talk. A personal fumble. Okay, confession time. By the time 1984 rolled around, I'd been playing RPGs for several years solidly, mainly AD&D with some Traveller and Gamma World, plus a sprinkling of RuneQuest for good measure. Too much of a good thing? Well, with all that non-stop gaming, I'd become a little, well, jaded with my group and role-playing games in general. So much so that I can barely bring myself to say it. When White Dwarf 56 was published, I decided not to buy it. I know. I can only hang my head in shame. When issue 57 hit the shops a month later, I had a rush of remorse and started buying the magazine again. I managed to buy a copy of that missing issue from a mate at school. I'd learned my lesson, and my loyalty remained steadfast from then on. Nobody tell Ian Livingstone, yeah? So that was 1984 in The Dwarf. If I'm honest, I don't think it hit the heights of the previous 2 years. Maybe that accounted for my wobble. But there's still some gems to be found, and the magazine remained an absolute cornerstone of the UK RPG scene. If nothing else, we knew we could all rely on Games Workshop, right? Little did we know what was to come in the years ahead.
But always, do not forget this, Winston. There will always be the intoxication of miniature figures, constantly increasing in number and constantly needing painting. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a Space Marine's boot stamping on your wallet. Forever!
The Groggies 1984, Part 2!
Right. Let's do the awards. I hope that you've got your nominees. As I get the categories, I've got the envelopes here. They're not gold envelopes, these are DL envelopes. So the first up is the Messianic Megalomaniac Award. This is our Gamesmaster Award that we present each year to Gamesmaster. So in 1984, Blythe, who are you going to give your Gamesmaster Award to?
I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to give it to Simon.
Right, okay.
In his AD&D games, he couldn't really do anything, could you? He was a player character. You weren't really allowed to do it. He's one of the, he had his ideas, didn't he? And you would kind of participate to some extent, but you weren't allowed to do much, really, to influence the game.
I remember this point as well, because we used to play a lot more with him while we were at school. And this summer, start of the breakup, wasn't it? Because unlike us, he wasn't going to college, he was going to work.
Yes.
And he started work, and so he had quite a bit of, he got a CD player, didn't he?
He did get a CD player, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's quite remarkable, wasn't it, Matt, at the time? Yeah.
An early adopter.
Yeah.
He also elevated his games to the point where they were a sort of narrative approach, because he never really had a lot of rules or really anything in his game other than a story or a premise. And I particularly remember that year, that was the year that he did the one where paper was scarce and we had to find paper. Do you remember this one?
Go on, keep going. It rings a vague, distant bell somewhere.
Yeah, we had these patrons who were trying to get us to rob a paper mill because they were bureaucrats who wanted to break into this paper mill and steal the paper. And I think this is the one where I encountered a ghost that turned my hair white.
I do remember that, yeah, yeah. But it wasn't like we could really influence the story particularly. That was the thing, wasn't it?
No, we just had to listen to the NPCs talking to each other.
Yeah, story gaming, the beginnings of story gaming, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I never liked it.
Amateur dramatic and edgelording. I don't know. I'm not sure what edgelording is.
I'm not sure what it is, but maybe it is. Maybe it is. Seems harsh. Seems harsh now to criticise someone. We were 16. This whole conversation comes with that caveat, doesn't it?
Yeah.
50, well, 50, summer of 84, we were 15, weren't we? He's a bit old. He was sort of 16 in October, the October, wasn't he, Simon?
Yeah.
Of 83, but we were still, we became 16 late, middle of that year or later on that year, didn't we? So
yeah,
seems harsh. But if he's a megalomania, there was an element of megalomania about it because it was about the story rather than about players influencing things. So yeah,
I really being able to do anything.
Yeah,
yeah.
Who would your nomination be?
Well, yeah. No, my nomination, because you're right to point out that up until 1984, had only played with Simon, ourselves, and a couple of people that we'd kind of recruited and lost after one game. But in February of that year, the response to our advert that we put in the previous year had come true. So I am saying, Blythe, that the Messianic Megalomaniac Award for 1984 should go to Herbs, who came. And he brought a whole new dimension to games mastering. Because remember, we'd only played the way that we played, but he was not afraid to have proper powered up characters and allow characters to be. I mean, we mentioned before, haven't we, the infamous Java Blast. So one of the characters had a crossbow that could fire javelins. Is that impossible? Nobody could imagine it, could we? What he also brought was like epic battles. He wasn't afraid to have crews of brews. Like we would have like one or two brews, and in case because the characters always died, didn't they? But he'd had like 15 of them, all of them with like weird and wonderful appearances. Because he was very imaginative, Herbs as well. He brought his imagination to bear on a number of things because he was very. He was quite well read, wasn't he, in terms of science fiction and fantasy?
Yeah, you're right there. Yeah, because I can remember once finding a room full of power storage crystals, and we when you ran Room Quest, you were very stingy with things like that, understandably so, I think. But I think that's probably the way to do it. Don't give people a room full of power storage crystals. And you find a room full of them. I think we all took some, but we took about three each because we thought it seems a bit much to just take 20 each. That seems like ridiculous. Yeah. Seems a bit of it like cheating almost. But yeah, he did. He had a, I think as well, I mean, everyone who runs a game has freewheels it a bit to some extent. I mean, you used to do that quite a bit. But he's someone who definitely upped the ante when it came to what you say improvising. Is improvising the right word? I'm not so sure. The famous bit where you know, we were teleported somewhere and he reached into his bag. I can see him doing it now. He reached into his bag without looking. This was the thing. The bag had quite a lot of stuff in it. He reached into the bag without looking and pulled out a Traveller Zadani spaceship supplement by, I don't know if it was by Fassa or somebody. And that's where we were on a Zadani spaceship as RuneQuest characters. And it was actually, did you plan this or did you just reach into your bag and the first thing that came out, that's where we were going to be. Didn't matter where, that's where we were.
I think that's where we encountered the room full of power storage crystals.
It was
the engine room of the spacecraft.
Yeah, they were like dilithium crystals in Star Trek, but they worked as power storage crystals, and I think Eddie had a go. Eddie kept having a bit of a go at him and saying, "Well, you're making this nonsense up. What are you doing? What are you doing, Herbs, with this?" And he was politely playing along with it.
Yeah, but it stuck in our minds.
Mm.
And the reason why I think he qualified for the role of Messianic Megalomania is, I think you collaborated in this. I wasn't part of it. The character assassination.
Oh, the character assassination. Yeah. Well, they had this guy, didn't they? Can't remember his name. He played in their games separately. I don't know if he'd been to their school or what.
It was Winnie, wasn't it? It was Winnie. Wasn't it Winnie?
No, it wasn't Winnie. No, not Winnie. Winnie with his Support Your Local Hooker t-shirt.
Yeah.
Remember? He turned up with my mum and dad's.
Yeah.
My dad thought, who are these people coming to my house? No, it wasn't Winnie. No, Winnie was all right. No, it wasn't. I can't remember his name. Dressed in like a jacket and trousers. You know, like he's like our age, but dressed like... in a slightly formal way. And I remember Eddie saying, he said, oh, Herbs is running the game. All right. So do you want to come to it? I said, yeah. So it was in Eddie's bedroom. And he said, oh, such and such is coming. But he said, Herbs is going to kill his character off. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he's going to bump his character off this session because his character is a real problem. He's like a power gamer, this guy. So he had, like you say, this supreme character with his Java blast and all this kind of stuff. He'd become a very problematic character. So what they decided to do.
I'm sure what they decided to do was have a chat about it and make sure.
No, because we were 16. No, that's not what they decided to do, is it?
That make sure that the players are kind of consented to everything.
It was planning a murder, you know. Yeah, it was. And Herb said, I remember feeling slightly uncomfortable about it. But then when we started playing, I kind of came round to their way of thinking, because this lad was the ultimate power gamer, and he had like an excuse for everything. So he's one of these people, those kind of players kind of starts unpacking the game a bit, so that every time he hits someone with a sword, he starts going, oh yeah, well look, they've taken so much damage that they're going to be in shock, aren't they? And you think, well yeah, but that's not in the rules in RuneQuest, you know. It might be stupid saying RuneQuest 2nd edition that you've had an arm lopped off, but you're carrying on fighting. Yeah, we know in the real world, if you get an arm lopped off, you are going to go into shock and blood loss. But the rules of the game are the rules of the game. That's what we do. But he would kind of dispute everything. And I think that was the problem, really, with him, that they thought, it's just a problem player. But they could have just said, we don't want to play with you anymore. But anyway, he ended up, this character, falling. And this kind of exemplifies what he was like. He ended up falling off a huge cliff to his death, his character. To be clear, not the real person, his character. Just so people are listening. People suddenly start listening to his podcast at this point. Yeah. It's his character.
And start tracking missing persons reports in Bolton in 1984.
And Herb said, oh, there you go, you're dead. And he went, No, I'm not. Terminal velocity. And I said, what? Terminal velocity, said, but there's a point, you only reach a certain speed when you fall a great height. And it was this long argument then about terminal velocity off a 200-foot cliff and what kind of damage you would take. And Herb, I think Herb said, oh, it's 200d6 damage. And he said, oh, no, it wouldn't be. No, it wouldn't be. It would be like 30d6. That's all it would be. And Eddie had said, you're still dead. He said, no, I'm not. I might roll all ones. And I've got armor. You know, and it was like this. They kind of plotted to do him in.
For that reason, I think Herbs deserves to be.
Yeah, I think you're right when you point that out. Yeah, there's definitely a bit of megalomania there. Yeah.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
I'm going to go next for the random roll on an encounter table. This is where we talk about conventions or meeting new people and mentioning 1984 is when we first met Eddie. There can be no other nominees, really, because that kind of changed the way we've played role-playing games ever since, hasn't it?
It did, yeah. I mean, I suppose there could be other nominees, and there was Herbs, and there was Martin, and there was Winnie. Support your local hooker, Winnie. But Eddie's the one who stuck, isn't he? Eddie was, of the four of them, Eddie was more like us. I think that's the thing, isn't it? He was more like us and we were more like him. Martin and Winnie just turned up for games. They didn't really socialise with us. And I suppose to some extent, Herbs didn't. They all lived quite a distance from us, apart from Eddie. Eddie just lived round the back of my house, didn't he? He'd been there all this time playing role-playing games. And that was what was strange about it, wasn't it? That he was so close in proximity to us, whereas the rest of them did live in other parts of Bolton, which, again, these days doesn't seem like a big deal. But, of course, when you don't have a car, it is a big deal, isn't it? Because you've got to get the balls and everything. So, yeah. So it probably has to be Eddie, doesn't it? It can't be anyone else, can there?
When you bring Eddie into it, the thing that I think Eddie brought was Call of Cthulhu. And we'd started playing that a lot more. To reflect that was Fungi from Yuggoth, is one I remember at that time. And so we should go next to the Olive Kingsburg players playing and people we play, because obviously Olive Kingsburg died in when we played Fungi from Yuggoth a couple of years, a few years ago. So in honor of her, we should remember Fungi from Yuggoth. But yeah, so who have you got for players playing and people that you play and characters, etc.? It's a bit of a loose, all of these categories are loose.
I might nominate myself for this. Yeah, because I think at the time I did run some things, but at that time, 1984, I think I was more of a player than running things. I'd been running stuff at school, hadn't I, suppose? Been running basic D&D. That went into 1984, the beginning part of 1984. So I was doing a lot of that. But then I think I did a lot of playing because I think like with Traveller, I'd kind of given up the ghost with Traveller a little bit because Simon was difficult in it. And of course, I'd discovered basic D&D and expert D&D and had a great time running that. You know, some of my fondest memories of running games, I suppose, were the early part of 84 when we were still at school. And I was running that at lunchtime for you and Moggy, wasn't it? I was running.
Yeah.
But when we left school, I don't remember running a huge amount over. I did run things, but I did more playing because Traveller had kind of stopped a little bit then because I was playing in Herb's games, I was playing in yours, played a bit of Eddie, played a bit of Simon. I was more of a player.
Yes.
So that in 84.
I remember we used to run a couple of games of Stormbringer over the summer of 84 with that group, this new group that we'd won. But as you say, I can't remember playing other games. We did play a lot at that time. I remember the start of the year playing basic role-playing. The start of the year as well should mark 1984. It's kind of significant because I was off school for the beginning of January. I don't even remember this. Well, that was the point where I fell, whilst on a country run at school, I fell on a brick that had been cemented with the corner exposed, and I fell on the brick and my left leg, of course.
Left leg, of course, yeah. Took a D6 damage.
D6 damage. And I had this, like, pyramid shape embedded into my leg that I've got to this day from 40 years ago.
Yeah, I do remember that. And I also remember the English project on the unexplained that we had to all hand in. And yours got top marks. And a lot of it, he copied out of the Goodies annuals. I remember sitting in English. This is, see, you're raking this up. Shouldn't do this. Shouldn't bring these things up. I remember doing the project, and I copied things. We both just copied things out of the Unexplained magazine, thinking, there we go. This is projects about the unexplained. Here's a bit on the UFOs. Here's a bit on Bigfoot, etc. It's quite good. And I can remember our English teacher you were back at school and you'd had all this time off and you'd done this huge project. But half of it was nothing to do with the unexplained. She just thought it was funny. It was just stuff. And I thought, you need to listen to Goodies book. Look, what's he playing at? And she thought it was great. I remember thinking, there's nothing to do with the unexplained.
And Starburst magazine. And Starburst.
Yeah.
You bring that up. 40 years, you've not let that lie.
I will not let it lie. It seemed unjust.
Are you sure it's my round?
You know, this is something that we've observed before, is I could not remember many of the characters that I played at that time. I couldn't name them. There's a handful of them. But you think we went through so many characters and we played those characters, yet none of them were distinctive.
Yeah.
I think it reflects the fact that we churned through them, so you couldn't get kind of a close association with them because they didn't last very long. But I can't remember. I think in Herbs' games, I was playing like Eagle Eye DiGiorni, who came with Griffin Mountain.
I think you're right. I can't remember many. I can remember Lashmar, who was my Stormble Rune Lord in RuneQuest. I can remember him. But it's hard to remember them. I think part of the reason you can't remember them is they were all the same. One of the interesting things then, when we were that age, is a lot of our characters were the same kind of characters for two reasons. One, because there was an element Maybe we were starting to grow out of it then in 84, but prior to that, there was an element of wish fulfillment in it, in that you wanted to be the hero. So you played heroic characters who ended up being the same. And also, you tended to maximize characters for survival purposes. So they were all very similar, weren't they? Because if you could engineer it so that they had good constitution, carried a bastard sword, medium shield, plate armor, those kind of things, you knew you had a better chance of survival. Nowadays, we're very different, aren't we, in that you play different types of character. And there's an element of trust with the GM that the fact I'm playing someone who's not very combat orientated in your game means you're not going to put me facing down a Balrog, because yeah, that's not what my character's about. But back in those days, it wasn't like that. If you created some character who was weak and interesting, but not particularly combat orientated or whatever, you'd be dead within a week, because the games were quite brutal.
Yeah,
I remember RuneQuest going through character after character. You know, it was a brutal thing. If you were dead, you were dead. That's it. Whereas nowadays, not quite the same. There's more of a trust thing between you and the GM. But, you know, if you want to play RuneQuest and play a bunch of merchants, for example, who aren't really fighty characters going across Prax, selling things, the Games Master's not going to go, oh, well, you can do that. But, you know, if you meet a bunch of a horde of brew, well, you know, you'll need more than that quarterstaff. The GM just wouldn't throw that against you, would? But in those days, that wasn't the case, was it? It was far more brutal than, and that's why I think you didn't have an attachment to characters, because, as you said, they weren't around long, most of them, and they all tended to be very similar.
So I want to make a nomination. In this period, I was introduced to at least 30, nearly 40 other players. Because in the autumn of that year, 1984, is when the PBM started, the player-by-mail game. And I'm not going to rehash that. If people want to hear that, go to episode 14. However, I think it's worth us talking about Racklash, because 40 years later, this island that was originally created by darkness and light to fight the battle on, we've revived it. We've run a campaign, a 10-session campaign in Racklash. My question to you is, did it bring back any memories of playing in that campaign world back then? Or did it feel completely different? Or how did it feel returning to that place that we created collectively in my bedroom on a Sunday afternoon back in 1984? What was it like going back to that 40 years later?
To be honest, it didn't bring back memories of playing it, because I'm not sure it brought back some memories of playing it. But I think the interesting thing was that the world itself, because I do remember, I have a more vivid memory of creating it, the three of us creating it. And as I think you said, a few weeks ago to me, you could look at bits of it and you know who created it. You know which of us created it. You can say, well, that's a name you came up with, that's a name Eddie came up with, that's a name I came up with. That was kind of quite interesting. You could think, it was, you know, definitely was, because there's something about the bits of it that you can, probably to other people you'd can't tell, but I can tell which bits I create and which bits you created, which bits Eddie created, without remembering that, just off the way it looks and the names and that kind of thing. So, yeah. But it was strange. It was strange to go back to it. But I suppose what was also strange about it was, although it was like a familiar world that we created a long time ago, I think the style of adventuring in it was different. And I think that's something you can't really escape, the passage of time and the way you've matured as a player or as a games master in the way you run things, rather than when you think back to how we used to do things when we were a lot younger. It was a familiar world, but I think the way it was run, there was a different tone to it, I think.
Yeah, I think obviously, yeah. And I think on reflection, going back to it, it kind of exemplifies what we've been trying to do with the podcast, isn't it? That this thing that we hastily scribbled down, this map, that we did 40 years ago and bringing it back to life. And people call it old school Renaissance or old school role playing. And in a sense, it's probably the closest I've done to old school role playing because of some of the situations or something. But it's also mixed with other things that we've picked up along the way.
Yeah.
Over the past 14 years of coming back to playing, inevitably it's infused with that. So we're not playing the same way, of course not, because we were kids then and we're adults now and we're getting different things from it. But you're right, it shapes the way that those adventures go, doesn't it? And yeah, your relationship with your characters, you've probably got a deeper and closer relationship to your characters that you played in the more recent game than you ever did in any of the games that you played back then.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Because you think more about your character. And all our characters, mine, Mark's and Steve's characters and Eddie's, all felt different from each other. Whereas I think back in the day, they all felt a bit the same for that reason. And that's why they're not as memorable. And Lashmar, in a way, my rune lord, Lashmar, he's memorable because he survived.
Yeah.
But as a character, he was pretty much the same as all the other characters. He was just the one who survived and managed to get to a certain tipping point as a RuneQuest character where he was pretty good with things. You know, he ended up like 100%, 90% with his sword and shield. And you think, oh, yeah, he's a survivor. But he wasn't notable in any way from all the other characters. He just managed to survive and become a Rune Lord. That was the difference, wasn't it? But I think that's a big part of it.
What amused me about playing this campaign is that in my head created this city state where it's a point of collapse because the king is about to die. Mm-hmm. And there are all these warlords, these factions who are ready to maneuver. As soon as the king dies, they maneuver into place. And I assumed that it was going to be, you know, a political intrigue and, you know, playing the factions off against each other. But I made a big mistake by giving one of you a map. And what you decided was, let's not hang around in this city anymore. Let's go and find out where this map leads to.
Does it, all your plans don't survive contact with the players, do they? Yeah. That's the phrase, isn't it? Never survives your contact with the players. We're off.
Didn't stay in there. Yeah. Let's enjoy that. Perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that campaign when we come to reviewing this year. But for 1984.
What?
What did you nominate for this?
I haven't nominated anything yet. I don't know. Can't remember. Find it.
It's almost like we're making this up.
The Kinnisburg Players player. Me.
Oh, you.
I nominated.
That's why I can't remember it. It's you.
Oh, right. Yeah. Because I'm forgettable. Yeah. I can't remember my own name. Yeah, me, I nominated me.
Well, you win, Blythe, you win.
Thanks. Lee, at last I've got a groggy for something.
Oh no, they sat in our chairs.
Next up is New Kids on the Top, The Tabletop. So what nomination have you got for this?
There's a definite sense. A lot of them hit a bit of a nerve, as in that you think, oof. I mean, ElfQuest's one in there, you think, oh. But another, a famous, I mean, there's a few here that, as I said earlier, we would wince at. Adventures of Indiana Jones role-playing game.
Yeah.
Remember that being one where we were very sniffy about, because I think the reviews, and we say you should never trust a reviewer, but we did trust a reviewer. We said, Indiana Jones can't die. You play Indiana Jones and you can't die. We go, oh, what? It's ridiculous. Which, of course, again, seems funny now because we played Tales from the Loop and you can't die in Tales from the Loop. But I remember being very sniffy about that. Advanced Fighting Fantasy came out as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember being sniffy about that. Even though now I think it's not a bad game, actually.
Yeah.
It's quite a good little game, isn't it? But, you know.
We were very earnest, weren't we? I think
Toon came out. Sniffy about that.
Yeah, I've got that actually. And I remember reading them and just not understanding them because I was seeing it through the prism of, this is nothing like RuneQuest. This is not what I've done before. that's part of the consequence of us not having a wide set of players to engage with. Yeah. We weren't very open to new ideas at all. Everything that came up that was new, we scared. I mean, a couple of years later when GURPS came out, that just sounded boring and ridiculous. It sounded very utilitarian and
paranoia, innit? I remember that. Yeah. And I bought Paranoia. I think it was a year or two late. Didn't really click with me at all. But really, a very influential game, really.
Yeah.
But it didn't click with me. But if I had to nominate one from 84, drum roll.
You ready?
Dave Patterson, I hope you're listening. I'd probably have to say MERP.
MERP.
MERP. I bought it. We did play it. About some of the supplements, I did sort of like it. I think it was hard work and complicated. But again, back in the day, I think we tolerated a level of complexity. When I look at it now, I think it's a bit overcomplicated.
But I have good memories of us playing that.
But I think it's interesting, though, going back to what we've just been saying, that the one game I bought of all this list was MERP, which really just replicates, to some extent, D&D, doesn't it? It just replicates a sword and sorcery fantasy game. And I had D&D. I had basic expert D&D. I had Stormbringer. We played RuneQuest, but I went and bought MERP. When I look at all these games now, I think maybe that's the last one I would buy of this list, really, because it's just another fantasy game. But that was the one I went for because it felt, looking at this list now, felt comfortable. And I think you're right, having so few players to play with. You, it was really you and Eddie, to some extent Simon, although, like you say, he'd drifted off the scene a bit. I think there was a reluctance to go for anything a bit crazy because you were worried that the only two people that you could play with might roll their eyes and not want to play it.
Yeah.
So even though I looked at Toon or Indiana Jones, and I was sniffy about them, but if I'd got those games, it seemed like a big gamble to buy a game in knowing that there are only two people who play this with me. And they might just both go, this is rubbish. You don't like this. You've wasted your money. So you kind of default to MERP because you think, well, look, it's Lord of the Rings. It's swords and sorcery. It's elves and dwarves. We do that anyway. So that's a safe bet. There was an element of that. Like, so we kind of isolated, aren't you? If you had a big gaming club where there was 20 people turning up every Thursday night, well, you could take a gamble, couldn't you? But you couldn't. You didn't feel like you could take a gamble.
My nomination is one we didn't play a lot, but I bought and I was kind of obsessed about it for a while. And it was following a review that appeared in White Dwarf, and that's Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, which, quite a good game.
Which may have come out the year before. It might have been late 83, but nevertheless, I got it in 84. Mm. And that was like the closest thing to a completely different game than everything else that we were playing that we ran through a couple of times. But then again, some of the concepts that were in that, I just couldn't get my head around at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think the conclusion of this nostalgia, when you go back to this nostalgia blind, is this realization that
we're idiots.
We're idiots, yeah, but that's a given, isn't it? Well, I think what I've come to realize is that I'm enjoying playing games now much more than I ever did then. And even though we've got this kind of nostalgic affection because maintained our friendship, didn't it, when we were teenagers. Yeah. It's one of the reasons why we were stayed together, I guess. And, you know, and all through our lives, it's been like a touch point. Now more than ever, you think, well, actually, I'm getting more value from it because back then I was only really scratching the surface and not very good at it.
Yeah, it has. And you're right, it has kept us. It's kept us together. It's kept us together through those shaky moments, like the time you got top marks for your unexplained project, which was nicked from the goodies book. Things like that. It's kept us together. You're right. But no, I agree with you, actually. It is interesting to reflect on it because on the one hand, you could say what was great was back in the very early 80s when we got into role-playing games, we were right at the beginnings of it. in a strange way, by 84, mid to late 80s, we were like stuck in the mud a bit with it. We didn't really, we didn't know many people who played it. New games were coming out. They might have been for us, because, of course, we didn't buy a lot of these games. And most of these games on this list I've either not heard of, or I did hear of them, but I never played them and never bought them. But you're right, we were kind of out of touch with it. We were out of touch with it sooner than we realised.
Yeah.
I think we always, in our own personal mythology, we came out of touch, got out of touch with new games in the 90s. But I would say, to some extent, by even by 84, we were out of touch with some of these games.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
Weren't playing them.
Probably only in touch with it for a very short period of time. Very short period of time.
Yeah.
And you know what we've done over recent years? We've kind of looked at the 90s and we say, right, we missed the 90s. What was going on in the 90s? We've explored that. We've picked up new games that have come along since we've started playing again back in 2010, 11. Do you know what I think we should do next? Our next thing is that there were games out there that we didn't touch, and yet there are passionate advocates in our listeners.
Yeah.
Who love it, like Palladium games. There'll be people out there.
Yeah.
We never played any of the Palladium games. Yeah. There were people out there. So I think we should lay the challenge down for people to advocate their game. We play it with them. We get it. We understand it. And we'll do a podcast on it and have a fight club to say whether
it's any good or not.
Any good or not.
I agree. And that, yeah, because that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That to some extent, there's an element of fate to what games you're into, in that if my mum and dad had bought me one of these games for Christmas, we might have fond memories of it. But it is going back to that thing, we didn't have the money.
Yeah.
Didn't have the money and didn't have the players and GMs that required to experiment a bit. So it was quite a narrow circle, but there was an element of money as well to it, wasn't it? So again, going back to Merp, that wasn't cheap, but it felt like a safe bet because of what it was. Whereas if you spent money on something, some of these games, if they're expensive, you'd think, oh, well, now it's a bit of a gamble. But
I think we should invite people to proselytize, is that the word, about games that they loved. Convince us that we missed out.
I think the worrying thing about this discussion, though, is we have kind of proved we know even less than we started out. We know even less. We're doing some podcasts of role play, this authoritative way. Just looking at 1 year has proved we know even less. We've always admitted to knowing not very much, but we know even less now.
Yeah.
There's no point listening to us anymore. We know nothing about anything.
You know, if anything, what this podcast has been about is like a journey of discovery, isn't it? Oh.
Is this podcast supposed to be fun? There you go. That's it. One star.
And is, as the philosopher T. Swift said, you need to calm down. You're being too loud.
Wise words. You need to calm down.
It doesn't.
Where does it come from? Where does she get this wisdom? It's unnatural, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'd go on, but she goes on to rhyme gown with down, and it doesn't kind of work.
Oh.
That's the trouble with Taylor Swift, is that her rhyming schemes, when you get to a certain point, she kind of exhausts.
Yeah, runs out of options. Yeah.
Cheers, Blythe. Thanks.
Goodbye.
Do you like to peek behind the curtain? Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars takes you behind the scenes. We interview designers and discover how they make their games. What was the first spark, that first idea? How did that idea develop into a game thousands of people love and play? These are the questions we ask designers. So if you want in-depth interviews with people like Shane Helmsley, John Wick, Ed Greenwood, and John Harper, check out Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars on your favorite podcatcher.
1984, what an incredible year for gaming. We've only really scratched the surface. really serious when we say to you, the listener, to get in touch with us about your enthusiasm from that era, the games that you played that were released in that time, and let's get together and see what we can do for future episodes. Contact me, dirtthedice@gmail.com. Really good to have that piece from @DailyDwarf again. He's pretty active again on Blue Sky, so follow him there. Hopefully we'll hear more from him in 2025. I've got a few shout-outs to thank new patrons. There's been some comings and goings over the last couple of months, and I just wanted to recognise the people who contribute to make this possible. You can support this podcast in many ways by passing on and sharing and making sure that people are aware of it. The patrons throw a tip into the tip jar every month and make sure that this show is kept on the road. It also encourages the other projects that are associated with the podcast, including Grog Meat and all the other things like the book club, and it pays for boosts of the Discord server. So joining at Fancy Poof level, Joe-Yon Finch, Nathan Smith, Christian Flucker, and Jim Jupp. Hi, Jim. That's Bob's friend from Ghostbox. Okay. When it comes to the Sofa So Good level, I like to give a virtual gift. And this time, I'm going to draw from the games that were released in 1984 to try and inspire you to contact us with those games that you used to play. First up is Simon Boucher, who's been waiting patiently for a shout-out. Really, if you think I've missed you or have mangled your name in the past, then please get in touch and I'll make sure that I put it right. Simon, you've been waiting a long time for this, so sorry about that, but thank you. Here we go. You get Sky Realms of Jeroen. Next is AJS. I'm going to give him Powers and Perils. I bought a copy of that a few years ago. It has such a reputation at the time. P&P was going to change everything. Avalon Hill's contribution to the world of role-playing games. It's not that great, but I'd love to hear from anybody who actually played it. Next up, Colin Richardson. One of my favourites, Cyworld. And we've covered that a bit in the podcast. Next is Alan Wakefield. Oh, chill. The horror game. I'd like to know more about that. Next is Phil, aka Daft Old Fart. And he's got Flashing Blades, which we covered in the last episode. We don't just throw this thing together, you know. Next up is Sam Kelly. And he's got Time Master. There you go. And without further ado, we are out of time for this episode. I might be able to squeeze another one in 2025. We'll just have to see over the next couple of days. But it'll be coming soon anyway. And we're going to go to that the Fancy London. Until then, adios, amigos.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard.